Well, tonight we begin the part two of our God and the Skeptic series. We want to look at seven reasons for faith. Oh, did we? We're still processing. Okay. There you go. Try Jesus. If you don't like him, the devil will always take you back. So part two, seven reasons for faith. We saw seven reasons why the skeptical arguments are not true and should not be believed, but how about some positive reasons why Christianity should be believed? The first one is that belief in God solves many puzzles of life. If you don't have a right understanding of what life is, things are pretty puzzling. So let me share with you five of them. First one, how could the universe just begin? How does that happen accidentally? Science has come to the realization that the universe cannot be eternal and that it had a definite beginning. Now, they call it the Big Bang. It's supposed to have happened 15 billion years ago because it would take that long for the exploding particles to form into atoms, because you have just nothing, and that has to form into atoms. The atoms have to form then into molecules and then planets and then finally stars. In fact, some of the heavier metals and so on would have to go through an entire cycle where a star would have to die and be compressed down to make the heavy metals. And then that would be sent out and around. Scientist Francis Collins says, we have this very solid conclusion that the universe had an origin, the Big Bang. 15 billion years ago, the universe began with an unimaginably bright flash of energy from an infinitesimally small point. That implies that before that, there was nothing. I can't imagine how nature, in this case, the universe, could have created itself. And the very fact that the universe had a beginning implies that someone was able to begin it. And it seems to me that that had to be outside of nature. We don't have any power like that evident in nature today. Well, the Bible offers the account of beginnings from God's view. Genesis 1, the word that means creation from nothing, from no pre-existing materials, is bara. It is used three times in chapter 1, Genesis 1. In verse 1, it describes the original creation of matter, of stuff. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created, bara, the heaven and the earth. Down in verse 21, it describes the creation of living creatures. This was non-living matter. Now the creation of living creatures. God created, there's our word bara, great whales and every living creature that moveth from the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, every winged fowl after its kind, God saw that it was good. So at the beginning of living creatures, bara, creation, not from pre-existing materials. And then in verse 27, it describes the creation of man. So God created, bara, man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. So as Collins said, it's very hard to imagine the natural transition of nothing into something. How does nothing evolve into something? Everything in science, except evolution, tells us that life cannot spring from inanimate material. And the transition of non-living matter into living cells is unbelievable. Again, the transition from animal to man is a leap so great that it boggles the mind to imagine it. Today, of course, to soften that unimaginable leap, all we hear about is how smart the animals are, how they have their own language, that they, off in the corner, have a business going, make money. So not that big a deal, not too much difference between us and them. See, there is an enormous difference. There is no actual language. There is communication, but there's no actual language with the animals. So let us suppose that Collins is right about the idea that the cause of the beginning of the universe had to be something outside the universe, the best answer is God. This is that way that it answers it all. And, you know, what else could it be? A second argument, a second puzzle. How is it that everything necessary for life was exactly as needed? Under the concept of evolution, science has realized that certain situations had to be precisely balanced for life to happen and for it to continue. We're talking about fundamental regularities and constants of physics, like the speed of light, gravitational constant, the strength of the weak and strong nuclear forces. They must all have values within a very narrow range. Again, scientist Francis Collins says, when you look from the perspective of a scientist at the universe, it looks as if it, the universe, knew we were coming. There are 15 constants, the gravitational constant, various constants about the weak, the strong and weak nuclear force, etc., that have precise values. If any one of those constants was off by even one part in a million, or in some cases, by one part in a million million, the universe could not have actually come to the point where we see it. Matter would not have been able to coalesce into atoms, into molecules, and so on. There would have been no galaxy, no stars, no planets, no people. We have recently been informed that the speed of light is gradually slowing down, that the gravitational constant is not universal, but is set to accommodate life only in our part of the universe. Somehow, or someone explained it like this. Imagine a set here of dials, 15 separate dials, and a large number of dials all had to be tuned to within extremely narrow limits for life to begin and to continue. And look at them, every one set exactly to that. They've started calling this like the man setting, which indicates that it was done on purpose so man could exist. The only rebuttal Richard Dawkins, who was a big evolutionist, the only rebuttal he could make to this argument is that maybe there are trillions of universes and the dials were all set correctly only in this one. Trillions of universes are called into play to explain why his beliefs are better than faith in God. That's a pretty big leap of faith in itself. Third puzzle. Why is it that nature is regulated? All scientific inductive reasoning is based on the assumption that the laws of nature will be the same tomorrow as they are today. That you heat up water to a certain temperature and it'll boil. That'll be today, tomorrow, the next day. A little different when you're up in Denver. But inductive reasoning argues from the specifics to the general. You see, inductive reasoning. We take in the individual things, we argue then for the general truth. It demands that our present experience will hold true in the future. So if nature was constantly changing, if it was in this flux and flow and ever-changing concept, then no principles would stay the same. We could not use language. The person was talking about you never can step in the same river twice. What he meant was the water's passed on. It's a different river now. But it's you know, still water flowing in the same place, and we still call it by that river. But what if the word river didn't mean river? What if it was, everything was so changed, and in our mind was so changed, that no word would fit anything? We could not use language. We could not rely on memory. We would know nothing about tomorrow. So why is nature so regular? Back in the old days, secular humanists, David Hume and Bertrand Russell were deeply troubled by the fact that we have no idea why things stay the same. Science cannot prove regularity of nature. It just accepts it by faith. Any like that? They don't know why it's regular. They just, okay, we'll just act like it is. Aldous Huxley said this, consistency is contrary to nature, contrary to life. The only completely consistent people are the dead. It was a puzzle to him. Now, I find it interesting that science rose to its greatest heights in a civilization that believed in an all-powerful, unchanging God. When men assumed that God was in control, science developed. Now they turn away from the very source of regularity that makes reasoning possible. Talk about cutting your own throat or cutting off your nose to spite your face. So the troubling question of why nature is so regular, if it was developed from the debris of a cosmic explosion, can be solved if we take God into the equation. It takes a superintendent. It takes someone who's able to mold it into that image. The fourth puzzle, how can man sense beauty? Now be careful here, because if you say it's all an illusion, then you've lost all beauty in life. And more than one person has taken their life because there was nothing left in their life for that. Many people find beauty in the arts to give them a sense of meaning. Since our science tells us that there is no ultimate meaning, why is it that beauty makes us feel as if it does? Here's an example. The musician Leonard Bernstein.
Stein, it's German.
Yeah. Was a Jew who lived a morally unstable life. I don't want to say any more than that. But I'm trying to say he was not a fundamental Baptist, is what I'm trying to say. He said of Beethoven, Beethoven turned out pieces of breathtaking rightness. Rightness, that's the word, when you get the feeling that whatever note succeeds the last is the only possible note you can rightly, that can rightly happen at that instant, in that context, then chances are you're listening to Beethoven. Melodies, fugues, rhythm, leave them to the Tchaikovskys, the Hindemiths, the Ravels. Our boy has the real goods, the stuff from heaven. The power to make you feel at the finish something is right in the world. There is something that checks throughout, that follows its own law consistently, something we can trust that will never let us down. Meaning found within beauty. But if everything is, as science tells us, an accidental arrangement of atoms, then there can be no real purpose to life. We are accidents. We are machines built by accident. We're machines built by accident traveling through a universe that was built by accident. Can it get any more random than that? If this is so, then beauty is an illusion. Love is an illusion. These things, in fact, the evolutionists tell us, are echoes in your brain left over from the evolutionary development where some concept related to love and beauty helped your ancestors to survive. Hard to imagine that one. while you're staring at that beautiful sunset, some caveman would conk you in the head. How sad that the very things that make life worth living are labeled illusions in our world of science and evolution. Why is man universally captured by love and beauty? Believing in a God who made beauty for his creatures and designed them to love and be loved answers these deeply disturbing questions. And finally, this puzzle. If all these clues that point to God are but remnants of our evolutionary development, why do we trust our ability to think at all? Once the philosophers feel quite satisfied that they've demolished all of the indication that God exists, there's one more big question. If we, like you have told us, cannot trust our brains to reason that there is a God, how can we possibly trust it to tell us science and evolution are trustworthy? Why does it only work when you're saying it's trustworthy? In fact, how can we believe that anything our brain thinks has any merit at all? The amazing thing is this. We do trust our thinking about most things. And usually we find our rational thinking is correct. And it helps us through life in the real world. It's not like we just decide that everything's made out of Nerf and it works for us. It doesn't work like that. But how is that possible? Surely if our brains are so fallible that we trust in a God who is not there, those same brains must be fallible in many, many other areas, but they are not so dreadfully fallible. This points to the answer to the question, being that our brains have thought correctly about the matters of faith and creation and the existence of God. Puzzles in life. We're supposed to consider that to be the wonderment of the universe. Please, no answers.